My name is Kieran Ryan, and today we're joined in the studio by Peter Stain. Peter is head of the Triple BEE practice at Workman's. That's quite a mouthful. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's quite clear that the BEE Commission set up under the Act is beginning to flex its muscles. Essentially, any deal that's described as a major BEE transaction over $25 million must be referred to the Commission. And this became effective in 2016. Yet there still seems to be a lot of confusion as to the powers of the Commission to interdict a deal that is deemed non-compliant. And we've learned that nearly 20 entities, including Eskom, MTN, Netcare, are being investigated by the Commission for, amongst other things, possible violations of the BEE Act. And when I say BEE Act, of course, I am meaning Triple B, Double E Act.
Yes.
Can you outline some of the background to this and why the Commission is taking what appears to be a hardline stance against companies trying to do BEE deals?
I think one must distinguish the two basic roles of the Commission. One is, as you rightly say, the registration of major BEE transactions. It's very important to note that in terms of those regulations, the approval of the Commission is not required for the implementation of those transactions. And the Commission's obliged to issue a certificate of registration for the transaction. Where the uncertainty comes in, and I think unfortunately there is a lot of uncertainty with BEE in South Africa at the moment, is that the Commission has then got the documents, they've got within 90 days they can raise concerns. Now, if the parties don't remedy those BEE concerns, the Commission can launch an investigation into the transaction. So the second type is the Commission also can initiate complaints, investigations, and also receive complaints from third parties, disgruntled employees, competitors, customers, from the public, and they can then also investigate those. One has to distinguish the registration of transactions versus the general complaint approach. Now, with regard to the Commission, I think by way of background, it's quite useful to understand the legal framework. I mean, BEE in this country is effectively a policy by government to harness the private sector to assist their developmental goals, redress the ills of apartheid and the legacies of the past. Now, they do that. The key thing is the BEE rating of a company. And underlying that principle is that a company can choose which BEE rating it requires. There's no law that everyone must, you know, BEE ratings range from level 1, the top level, to level 8 or level 9, which is non-compliant. So it's up to a company and its shareholders to decide how to implement BEE. Now, that fundamentally is a commercial decision. It must make commercial sense. And that fundamentally depends on what does the company's customers want? What rating are they looking for? And more importantly, in sectors which are regulated, mining, gambling, etc., what rating is the regulator requiring to grant a license or concession or permit? So it's a business decision, fundamental business decision. And the methodology is set out by the Minister of Trade and Industry in codes of good practice which have been issued in terms of the BEE Act. Now, in 2015, they changed the BEE Act to criminalize fronting practices. And so when the codes are really the starting point. Your BEE rating is determined in terms of the codes. But what happened when they criminalized fronting practices is that they inserted a definition in the Act of fronting practice, which is so wide that it's very difficult to interpret. I mean, it's basically anything which directly or indirectly undermines or frustrates the achievements of the objects of the BEE Act. And it's criminal. So the consequences are serious for individuals. Up to 10 years jail and or a fine. For companies, a fine of up to 10% of turnover, and also being placed on the register of defaulters held by National Treasury. So basically you can't deal with government or state entities for 10 years. Very serious consequences.
Who will make that decision? Will that be up to the Commission, or is that going to be decided by the courts?
Well, I think the key thing, the Commission is not empowered to impose penalties or fines. Ultimately, the Commission will investigate. It's primarily an investigative body. It also has the power to apply to court to stop a fronting practice or other contravention of the BEE Act. It hasn't exercised that power. But effectively, it's an investigative body and possibly a prosecutorial, if they apply to court, prosecutorial body. They're not a final decision-making body as to whether or not criminal offence has taken place. So in terms of the Act, in fact, they say, the Act says that if the Commission believes a fronting practice has taken place, they must refer it to this police or the National Prosecuting Authority.
Or the tax authority?
Well, if they believe that there's been a tax, transfer pricing issue or something, or as in the MTN case, they'd refer MTN to ICASA. with a possible recommendation that the license be reviewed of MTN. So they can refer to a regulatory body, but once they've done that, they really drop out of the picture. And it's up to the National Prosecuting Authority to decide whether or not to prosecute. And if so, then the court will decide whether or not to find the person or company guilty, and then also decide whether or not what the penalty will be.
Okay, so there's a 90-day window from the time that the deal is announced before the commission can actually intervene or apply for an interdict to stop a transaction. Well, what if in that 90 days elapses and the commission hasn't raised a squeak? Well, what happens then?
In practice, and the regulations, I mean, this is all dealt with in the regulations issued under the BE Act. It's not clear what happens. The regulations say the commission has 90 days to raise concerns. Now, if they don't raise concerns within the 90 days, in my view, that must mean that the parties can proceed accordingly, that there are no concerns. In practice, there has been a bit of a interregnum with time periods. The commission sometimes sends comments after the 90 days. Mm. Of course, then the parties are placed in the invidious position of they've implemented their transaction, as they were entitled to do, and now concerns are being raised regarding the commercial terms and conditions of the transaction. And that is a real concern, because compliance with the codes, I think, is important. If you don't comply with the codes, you won't get the BEE points, especially on ownership. And broad-based ownership trusts and schemes have been in the firing line with the commission, and in some cases, I think, justifiably so. Because I'm still amazed that I see trust deeds given to me which clearly don't comply with the requirements of the codes as changed in 2015. So compliance with the codes, I think, is a given. You've got to be careful, and business needs to make sure that they comply with the codes to get the ownership points. When you get to the commission almost in commenting that they don't like the restrictions on disposal of shares by the BE shareholder, or they don't like the terms and conditions of the loan agreement, funding agreements, you know, then you're outside the ambit of the codes. The codes don't regulate the commercial terms and conditions of a BEE transaction. So, and in my view, unless the codes or the Act expressly prohibit a certain term or condition in a transaction, the Commission should not interfere. So it causes great uncertainty if the Commission effectively tries to renegotiate the deal in favor of the BEE party.
Right, exactly. I think this would be a concern for a lot of businesses that have concluded or are concluding deals. 90 days elapses. They think, you know, the road ahead is clear. And then all of a sudden they find retrospectively, you know, the Commission decides to reopen the file, so to speak. That could be extremely disruptive to business going forward.
Now, I think the key thing, one needs certainty. I think generally speaking, business wants to comply. They need to understand what the rules are. You know, in my experience, I've never come across a company that deliberately wants to flout the rules, because that would obviously be clear fronting. Fronting is low-hanging fruit. Mm. You know, we all know basically it's a type of fraud, yep, and should be criminalized. But if you're going to get into discussion as to whether or not the right of one of your appointed directors to be a member of a quorum, to be present for a quorum of the board, or a veto right over dividends, or that dividends must be used firstly to repay a loan. I mean, those are fundamental commercial terms and conditions, which I think the Commission and the authorities must be very careful about getting involved in that sort of nitty-gritty, and more importantly, insinuating or actually blatantly saying that these are elements of fronting, because fronting is a criminal offence. And if that's made public, it can certainly harm a business. Just the allegation.
Yes.
The media will say, Company X accused of fronting by the BE Commission. Their customers, their shareholders, listed companies particularly.
Oh, it could get, very in, get serious into the zone of
just
defamation.
The allegation.
Yeah, just
and
the allegation.
And you go to court, and a year or two later, you're vindicated.
It could destroy
a
business.
It's the damage in the interim that's the problem.
Right. Can you talk about some of the recent decisions made by the Commission, such as the MTN Zakhele Futhi scheme? That was set up by MTN to broaden black ownership. What the Act requires is that black shareholders must also be able to exercise their voting rights and obtain board representation. I think there was a bit more to this decision. Can you explain what went on and why this was important?
Well, I think you mentioned that the Act requires it. Now, the Act doesn't require it. I think it's getting back to basic principles, and I think this is a key objective of the Act. The objective of the Act is to promote broad-based black ownership of assets in this country. Now, a scheme like MTN Zakhele effectively made an interest shares in a listed company available to ordinary black people at a 20% discount. Now, if anything, that is in line with the objectives of the Act. I think that's the starting point. The BEE Commission sort of raised issues about certain restrictions. I think the MTN appointed the chairman of the board of the MTN Zakhele. MTN appointed director to be present for a quorum. MTN consent was required for dividends to be declared. And the commission found problems with these restrictions. Your point on management. Now, the commission said and recommended that MTN Zakhele, a 4% shareholder, must be represented on the board of directors of MTN Group. Now, in normal commercial practice, firstly, a 4% shareholder is a minority. You know, they don't usually are given a right to be represented on the board. Secondly, the Companies Act clearly states that management of a company vests in the board of directors, not the shareholders. And most importantly, I think, the whole issue of management and board composition is not measured under the ownership section of the codes. It's measured under management control. So the commission, by saying that the MTN Zakhele scheme, and they use the word, contains elements of fronting, which in itself is very vague, because the investors in MTN Zakhele were passive shareholders. Now, all shareholders in a listed entity are effectively passive. They don't get involved in management. They don't have rights to appoint directors. So by conflating this management control element and the ownership element, the commission is actually almost adding a new requirement for BEE ownership. There's no requirement in the BEE ownership of the codes to that BEE shareholders must be represented on the board or be involved in management in any way.
That is a very interesting point. In your opinion, did the commission overstep the mark in coming to
again,
that decision?
And it's curious that they published this decision, because the BEE Act, and we mentioned earlier the serious consequences of allegations being made in public which have not been tested and found to be valid in a court, that the commission published their findings and recommendations. The BEE Act clearly states, and it's a section of the BEE Act, says the commission may not publish its findings and recommendations unless the six-month period for administrative review in terms of the Promotion of the Administrative Justice Act has expired and no administrative review has taken place. If an administrative review is launched by the company, the commission cannot publish its findings and recommendations until that whole legal process is finished. If the commission actually refers the company for prosecution by the NPA, their findings and recommendations cannot be published until such time as that whole process, the criminal process, has finished. If the company is acquitted by a criminal court, they can't publish the findings. If the NPA decides not to prosecute, they cannot publish the findings. So this is in the Act. So I find it quite curious that the MTN findings and recommendations were published, and that's I'm not sure what the reason is.
Would MTN have a claim against the commission? Is there any liability on the commission for making a misstep?
You know, the devil's always in the detail in these things. I mean, what are the facts? I mean, clearly, I don't think the commission would deliberately breach the Act. But what are the facts? The difficulty here is one of the recommendations. The commission, you know, they say, made these findings. If you don't accept our recommendations, we will report you to the police and the National Prosecuting Authority. Now, again, I find that approach problematic, because the Act, again, quite clearly states that if the commission is of the view that a fronting practice has occurred, there's no discretion, they must refer it to the National Prosecuting Authority and the police. So it does raise a question as to whether they can sort of make a finding and then recommend something with a threat in the background that if you don't accept all our recommendations, we will report you.
Right. It looks like there's going to be some legal argy-bargy going on to find out exactly what are the limitations of the commission's powers.
Well, I think that's important, because ultimately we need, as lawyers and advisors and business and the commission, I think, in fairness to them, they have a very vital, important role to play. But I think we need certainty. At the moment, particularly the comments that are coming out raising concerns, couched as BEE concerns, on commercial terms and conditions of transactions, I think is really problematic.
Right. We have a couple of questions coming through, but just before we get on to them, I wanted to ask you this one about the penalties for non-compliance that can be applied in terms of the Act. And have any of these penalties been imposed in the past? They're pretty severe penalties.
Absolutely. You know, again, it's a question of Firstly and foremost, and I think this is really important, the commission cannot impose penalties. Now, what happens in certain cases is they will make a finding, raise a BE concern, and one of their recommendations might be that a certain amount is paid, for example, to the National Skills Fund. That recommendation is not legally binding on the company being investigated. As I said earlier, if the commission decides to refer the matter to the police or the National Prosecuting Authority for investigation, it's up to the National Prosecuting Authority to decide whether or not to institute a criminal prosecution. And then the consequences for individuals are severe, up to 10 years jail and or a fine, companies up to 10% of turnover fines, and then being placed prohibited from dealing with state entities and state tenders for 10 years. So those consequences are key. But again, I must emphasize that's on the premised on the basis that you are found guilty in a criminal court of either affronting practice, misrepresenting your BEE status, attempting to misrepresent your BEE status, or other contraventions of the Act. And that's by a criminal court, not the commission.
So it's going to be quite a tall order to get a criminal conviction, I would imagine, because you have to prove intent, do you not?
Well, that's the thing. Of course, the Act defines intent as actual knowledge and knowledge which you ought reasonably to have known, which inevitably, you know, leads you into complicated constitutional issues. Right. Because if people are going to go to jail for 10 years, then I go back to the fronting practice definition, anything which undermines the objectives of the Act. I think it's a fundamental principle of our common law that if you're going to put someone in jail for up to 10 years, you must be very clear as to what is criminalized. And I think that's one of the problems with the definition of fronting practice. It's far too wide.
Yeah.
I think we do need a case before the courts. In fact, there was a case which I think was a low-hanging fruit. The case involving Sufambo, a Spanish firm, Foslo, and the Prasa tender, locomotive tender, which was clearly Sufambo was granted the tender. It was 100% black-owned, had no employees, no business. Effectively, the entire tender was outsourced to the Spanish.
Yeah, it was a company with a fax machine. Yeah. I don't even know if they had that. Yeah.
It's a classic opportunistic intermediary.
Yeah.
And so that's a clear front. In fact, it went to court, and the court said, this is a fronting practice. But unfortunately, and if the court made that decision, that is a case for the National Prosecuting Authority to take forward. But nothing has happened.
Well,
so we need a case.
Not only that, I think the trains didn't fit our gauge.
It was an absolute fiasco.
They were too tall.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
But I think there's a good example of where the National Prosecuting Authority needs to find a case where we can get some case law and precedent.
Right. We have a question here from Teboho. He's asking, if an international company with shareholders in South Africa is found to be fronting, who would be fined, the local entity or the parent company?
Look, I think it's engaging in a fronting practice. So it's very fact-specific. But ultimately, it depends. I mean, engaging in a fronting practice, I mean, it's clearly the measured entity will be the South African company. Now, it could involve shareholders, it could involve executives of the company, it could involve the verification agent who's, I mean, remember, the certificates are not issued by the company. They must get an accredited verification agent who signs off on it. So it's very fact specific. Anyone who engages in a fronting practice runs the risk of criminal prosecution.
Right.
Including, I might add, the BEE shareholders. In the case I mentioned with Sufambo and Foslo, I mean, Sufambo was a willing participant and got its commission for just getting the tender and being the intermediary.
Right.
So I think it's not confined necessarily to the company.
Okay, and now we have a question from Brendan. Are there instances in which the commercial structure of a BEE deal can be seen validly as fronting, i.e., if all benefits are extracted from the black shareholders? Does that make sense to you, what he's asking there?
You know, I think much of it does depend on the structuring, you know, and the commercial intent. I mean, loan funding is usually paid out of dividends. Now, the mere fact that dividends are used to repay a loan and the loan is repaid, I don't think that could have possibly amount to fronting. But there are structures, for example, where I think the commission does raise this. If the black shareholder doesn't receive a dividend, I think the valid inquiry is, why is that? If the reason is because the company just wasn't profitable, the market being what it is, and no shareholder got a dividend, then I think that's a valid defense. If, however, it's because the non-black shareholders were all the management and they were getting bonuses and at the end of their, they were getting the value and the black shareholder and no shareholder was getting a dividend, then I think there's a potential problem. So it's very fact specific. But commercial terms and conditions need to be carefully considered. And you know, if you're going to put restrictions on a shareholder, and I mean, a lot of these commercial deals also place restrictions on the non-black shareholder. And again, this is a negotiation. This is structured for tax efficiency, for practical commercial corporate reasons. So as soon as you start tinkering with the commercial terms and conditions and saying some must be changed, there's a ripple effect throughout the entire transaction. But the point is that I think restrictions on black shareholders need to be carefully considered. Issues of where, for example, if a trust structure is used, and this is common, the Commission has raised this in quite sweeping terms by saying a vast majority of broad-based schemes are not compliant. I mean, I'd like to see the statistics on that because I'm a details person. But if, for example, a trust is used in your structure, and the trust use of trusts, employee share trusts or broad-based schemes, is incentivized by the codes. You get 3 extra ownership points by using these entities in your structure. But if they are effectively controlled by the company or the other shareholder, then the argument, and I think there's an argument can be made that, okay, this is not a third-party black owner, it's actually controlled by the white shareholder or the company. Yeah. So again, it's very fact-specific, and the devil's always in the detail, I always say.
Right. So the Commission is quite concerned about black shareholders taking on debt to acquire shares. And we know from the early days of BEE that this was a reason why so many of these schemes failed. It just became too onerous to service the debt. Many of these historical BEE deals required a rise in share price for the black shareholders to receive any real benefit. And I'm thinking of share deals done by Naspers, Sasol, Barloworld, for example. And they generally reported to have fallen short of expectations. Are there better ways of structuring these deals? And how does the Commission propose to deal with these share schemes that are heavily dependent on debt?
I think the whole concept of debt is dealt with in the codes. Again, the codes are really the starting point for any BEE rating. What the codes in ownership measure are so-called net value, which is a way of measuring the debt-free portion of the shareholding. And the companies are incentivized, and basically 8 out of 25 points are allocated to net value. So the question of debt is something which is taken into account in the codes. 2 quite complicated formulae are used to calculate the net value score of a company, the debt-free portion in simplistic terms. And what the codes changed in 2015 to say, if a company doesn't score at least 3.2 of the 8, 40% of the total, they will automatically be downgraded by one level. So if they scored a level 3 rating, because they didn't meet the net value minimum, they would automatically be downgraded to level 4. So that's the framework within the codes. So obviously the servicing of the debt is a key issue. But of course, you cannot factor out commercial risk. There's no right to profit. There's no right to a dividend. The Companies Act regulates the ability of a company to declare dividends. You know, there's a solvency and liquidity test in the Act, which prohibits a board from declaring a dividend if the company fails the test. So you have this conundrum. Now, if dividends are declared and they are purely used to service the debt, the Commission sometimes raises issues about that structure.
Okay, here's a broad question. In your opinion, is the BEE Act delivering on its intended objectives, and how do we measure that?
But I think, again, one has to put the BEE Act and the BEE framework in context. You know, it's one policy tool used by government. And effectively, it's, as I said earlier, the government is harnessing the private sector to support its transformation initiatives. And BEE Act, ownership is always the hot potato in BEE. But equally, if not more important, are the other 4 elements of BEE, which combine to determine a company's BEE status, which is management control, which is the board of directors, how many black managers in senior, middle management, lower management positions are there, skills development initiatives by the company, what is the company doing to upskill its black workers and unemployed black people, procurement, who are they procuring from? Are they procuring from 100% black-owned firms, 51% black-owned firms, or firms who have a good BEE rating? Enterprise development, what are they doing to help smaller firms, firms with good BEE ratings? And lastly, socioeconomic development, charitable initiatives. So you've got to look at it as a package. Now, BEE itself is really the private sector's contribution. You cannot divorce transformation from other challenges which we have in this country. Education and skills, 50% youth unemployment, you know, lack of growth, you know, healthcare. Those are issues. So the BEE Act, has it contributed? I think the counterfactual would be if we'd never had any BEE, would we have been further down the road towards transformation? Or, and I think this is a valid question, is the policy working in a sense that should we review it? The last time it was reviewed 4 years ago, you got criminalization, you got enforcement, you got stricter rules.
Well, is it becoming too convoluted? That's a question a lot of businesses are asking. You know, you almost need a team in-house to monitor your compliance with the Act.
And the costs involved in that as well. So, you know, I think certainty is really important. And I think the government has tried to bring certainty through the codes. But I think this fronting practice definition is too wide, and that causes a lot of uncertainty.
When you're advising companies on structuring a BEE deal, what are some of the landmines to look out for?
Look, I think, as I mentioned earlier, use of trusts, it's incentivized, but you have to be really careful how the trusts are structured. I think it's a substance over form debate. There are several structures where effectively BEE ownerships are effectively sold, in inverted commas. I think I'm not saying you can't generalize, but where a solution is sold, you know, you want a long-term fix, and it's substance over form analysis. You know, cession of voting rights, temporary solutions, I think are not necessarily a long-term solution. Ensuring compliance with the codes, and that I think goes to the heart of the rating. And that's where the verification agent is actually under huge pressure to maintain compliance with the codes. But I think the restrictions on BEE shareholders, that's something that, I mean, I would advise clients not to impose restrictions unless they're really commercially necessary and justifiable.
Okay, Brendan asked another question, quite a good one here. Are there examples of best practice in terms of BEE schemes?
You know, going back to MTN Zakhele, I think that was a great scheme, and it's on a substance over form analysis.
Right.
If you think about it, ordinary black people, the thing is broad-based empowerment. Things like on an ownership basis to allow ordinary black people to acquire shares in a listed company. I think that's a great scheme.
Right.
But again, the other elements of BEE are often neglected. I mean, small business, procurement, enterprise development, those are key deliverables as well.
All right, what about state procurement? When can subcontracting to a state-owned entity amount to fronting?
Well, I think they changed the regulations from 1 April 2017 to state that not more than 25% of a state tender can be subcontracted to a firm that has a weaker BEE rating than the original contracting party. And I mentioned the Swifambo case earlier, where a 100% black-owned firm was granted the tender but effectively subcontracted the entire tender to a foreign entity.
Right, that's just not going to be possible going forward.
So that I think contributed to the change in the regulations, which are binding on state entities and state-owned entities.
Right. Is there resistance from companies to implementing the requirements of the Act? I mean, a lot of companies are saying that this is becoming overly regulated and prescriptive, and in fact, just the compliance aspect of it is a major cost to the companies. What's your feeling about that?
Look, I think companies want to comply. You know, basically, people want to comply with the law. That's good governance. That's good business practice. The difficulty, I think, is when the uncertainty creeps in. You know, when there's uncertainty as to whether or not your trust complies with the codes or not. I think that, you know, that's an example where I think DTI, the Department of Trade and Industry, because again, the commission is not the custodian of the codes. The codes are fall under the control of the Minister of Trade and Industry. The minister can clarify and amend the codes to make things clear.
Right, so it's clear one is going to have to do a BEE deal with somebody like yourself at your side. You definitely need advice when you're going down this road.
Yeah. Look, my advice is always keep it simple unless there's a commercial benefit to making it complicated.
Right, Peter, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much for coming in.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.